The next discussion point related to management of patients who are elderly or with a poor performance status. Dr. Lilienbaum re-presented data from ASCO demonstrating in PS2 patients an advantage for carboplatin paclitaxel over erlotinib. Dr. Sosinski commented on this challenging issue.
We all see patients who are poor performance status, and you chat with them, and, you know, 3 months earlier they were walking 18 holes of golf and they got sick because they got cancer. They really had no other comorbidities. I tend to, from a treatment point of view, be more aggressive with those patients than the other group of patients that I see that were, as you talk to them, they were sitting in their apartment on O2 2 years ago and have an ejection fraction of 25%. They aren't going to get better a lot with chemotherapy. So I take a different approach and tend to use single agents in those patients. But in the other patient where I think the performance status is really pushed by the cancer, I believe the CLGB and Ruggiero's data. I think two drugs are better than one in that setting.
Ruggiero, how do you approach PS2, either because of the tumor or because of underlying disease?
I think this is something we've discussed for a while now since the CLGB study was presented. I think it makes a lot of sense. And intuitively, you would like to approach these two subsets of patients a little differently. Yet, we have no prospective data, no validation that this is indeed the case. So I do what I think most people do here. If I have a patient who was relatively healthy 3 or 4 months ago and comes in with rampant disease-related symptoms and a rapidly dropping performance status, I think that patient should receive combination chemotherapy. A patient who's had a borderline functional status, comorbidities, et cetera, and the impact of the cancer on their overall performance status is either relatively minor or not accessible, so to speak, then I tend to be a little bit more cautious. Again, that's because it makes sense, but not because we have any data to that effect.
So what do you do?
The whole issue of comorbidities and performance status remains completely unclear, and we need to pursue this a little better.
But when you say cautious, what's your usual approach?
Then I use single agent therapy. For the first patient that we believe has a performance status that's low due to cancer-related symptoms, I will use a doublet, and so far I have not used bevacizumab in that setting. For a patient who has comorbidities, et cetera, then I use a single agent most of the times.
Jack?
I'm actually surprised by how convergent everyone was considering the range of options available. I would say that for the CALGB trial that Ruggiero presented and published, 9730, that we have all integrated that into our thought process, that it is certainly feasible and potentially optimal to give a carbo-based doublet chemotherapy to potentially reversible patients with performance status 2. However, we all know that those were patients who somebody thought it was at least feasible to give a doublet to, and that might not be every person who could be considered PS2, and probably was not as likely to be the patients who, because of comorbidity, would never rise above PS2. And I think that's part of why we have really a difference between single agent chemo as the prevailing choice for chronic PS2 and doublet for the reversible.
Mark?
The PS2 population is a very toxicity-sensitive population, and so therefore the toxicity risk may outweigh any potential benefit you get in a group of patients whose overall survival is significantly poorer than the PS0-1 patients.
I mean, that patient asks you, again, patient is perfectly healthy, has rapidly progressive, massive tumor, and what's the chance I'm going to be alive 3 months from now or 6 months from now?
Right. I mean, I think that is a more compelling argument to consider it in that type of population. Those patients tend to be different than, I think, perhaps the more typical PS2 patient, which has the comorbidity.
Sure.
So from the comorbidities point of view, I probably would not.
That's a different story.
Right. But if you've got a younger patient who is rapidly going downhill, I can understand. You're exactly right. If you don't get control of the disease, this patient in the next 2 to 3 months is in big trouble.
The 2006 ASCO meeting continued the recent trend for increasing clinical research on the fascinating topics of predictors of response to TKIs, as commented on by Dr. Lynch.
Where are we now with molecular profiling in EGFR TKI therapy? And I think that we have 6 or 7 candidate markers at this point. I think that the burden exists to show that any one molecular predictive factor will be better than clinical characteristics. If one looks at the trial that Vince Miller and Passiani are doing looking at never smokers, I think we have a pretty high threshold to show that mutations or gene amplification or FISH positivity or IHC or proteomics will be better than just selecting never smokers for treatment with TKIs. If you look across multiple studies, there's pretty widespread agreement that never smokers, adenocarcinoma, women, and Asians are the groups that do best with TKI therapy. And will any molecular test prove superior? And let's first comment on mutations. I think that we at ASCO this year have come to an understanding that TK mutations are prognostic for improved survival independent of treatment. Patients with mutations do better almost regardless of what treatment they get. Exon 19 deletions are associated with improved response and survival compared to other activating mutations. I think that's pretty clear now that this is a more favorable mutation to have. Exon 20 mutations are often predictive of resistance to TKI, particularly in preclinical modeling. Some of the difficulty, and interesting what Mark and Vince think about this, some of the difficulty in doing studies now is that many of the more recent trials have just looked at exon 19 and exon 21 in terms of eligibility. So the PASA-RES trial from Spain only looked at 19 and 21, and so they didn't look at exon 20. Much of our feeling about resistance on exon 20 mutations comes from preclinical modeling systems of William Powell and Matt Meyerson that have looked at that. So curious what these will mean clinically. And then what we're beginning to learn now is that about 90 to 95% of all these mutations are either going to be exon 19 deletions or exon 21 point mutations. So can we use this information to select patients up front for therapy? We have done that at Mass General Dana-Farber and actually a North American study that Leisha Sequist is heading. We are doing full sequencing of 18 to 24 at 10 North American sites. We have screened 80 patients with stage 4 disease up front. 20 mutation-positive patients have been under treatment. The goal is for 30 patients, and the goal is for a response rate of greater than 65%. This year at ASCO, we saw the Spanish target study. Interestingly, both our group and the group from Spain chose the same name for the study. And this was the PASA-RES study. They screened 1,047 patients for exon 19 deletions and exon 21 point mutations. They found a mutation rate of 15.1%. The overall response rate was 82%. Exon 19 deletions, it was 95%. 21, it was 67%. Time to progression, 13 months. 1 year overall survival, 82%. Really very impressive data that you can use selection of patients by mutations to get very, very nice first-line data. What about FISH? FISH is obviously important as a way of predicting for better outcome. We know the data from Canada, which looked at low copy number versus high copy number. Patients with high copy number for second and third line lung cancer clearly had a better outcome in terms of survival. What's interesting is that unlike the Herceptin story, what we're looking at here is not usually gene amplification, but actually high polysomy, which is probably biologically different than gene amplification. Now, from ASCO this year, we have the OncoBell study, which looked at never smokers and or FISH-positive patients pretreated with chemo or not, candidates for chemotherapy treated with gefitinib. This was presented by the group from Italy. 42 patients, response rate. If you were FISH-positive, response rate was 68% versus 9%. If you're FISH-negative, if you're mutation-positive, 58% versus 27%. The numbers in the group was a little bit more heterogeneous than the PASA-RES study. However, it did show that you could select patients by FISH as well and select a group of patients up front that would have a better outcome than patients otherwise.
How often does FISH go with mutation positivity?
Often. If you're looking at true amplification, gene amplification doesn't necessarily correlate with mutation status. But if you look at the high polysomy, very often they correlate together. In most studies, it's about two-thirds are overlap. So you may well be looking, and it's a very good point, Roy, we may well be looking at the same group of patients in many of these circumstances. And then finally, a third marker of a tumor which is dependent upon EGFR is protein expression. And protein expression, I think, is also something which will be important for selecting patients for therapy, particularly maybe even in the adjuvant study. I want to give one more point why I think that mutation analysis might be very important, and that's the concept of resistance. Again, work at Memorial, work at Harvard, work at other centers around the country have shown that resistance can often be predicted by the type of mutation. And this is Dr. Kobayashi's New England Journal of Medicine paper from February of last year, where they described the T790 mutation. Now, why is the T790 mutation important? important? It's important because it may actually predict for different TKIs that might work in that setting. Just a couple conclusions. I think EGFR mutations clearly predict for clinical benefit. I think they'll be useful in choosing agents in the setting of resistance, both primary and acquired. I also think it will be the best way to select patients for first-line therapy. Most importantly, mutations help explain the biology. When I push the FISH crowd on what does FISH mean, what does FISH tell us about the biology of cancer, it's kind of hard to explain exactly what's happening there. EGFR gene copy number, I think, is likely the best measure for predicting survival in second and third line patients, because I think what it does, it takes the 40% of patients who've got tumors that are EGFR driven, and that tells you the group of patients who are going to do best in second and third line. So I think gene copy number in FISH clearly has a role in terms of how we're looking at patients. But unlike HER2 amplification, FISH is really looking at high polysomy. And I think more work is needed on trying to understand what the biologic implications of this are. And it doesn't give you that same window on resistance.
Dr. Miller began the discussion following Dr. Lynch's summary by commenting on the use of EGFR mutation testing in clinical practice.
Doctors can send slides to Genzyme and get a result back within 7 to 10 working days if there's adequate tissue for mutation status. They do all 18 through 24.
All of them.
Yeah, so they actually do more than some of the centers do that have quick diagnostic PCR-based assays, although their specific assays may be a little bit less sensitive. But I think the point about KRAS, after ASCO this year when we revisited BR21, we actually have the closest thing to a consensus amongst all the different factions, so to speak, in this area, that we know KRAS is an adverse prognostic factor in lung cancer, but clearly patients with KRAS mutations probably do not benefit from EGFR TKIs and are better suited by chemo. And we're actually designing a trial, an assignment trial at Memorial, where people have a biopsy. We'll do KRAS mutation and put out those who have KRAS mutations. We just don't think that's a fair thing for them to get erlotinib.
So from a practical clinical perspective, in which situations do you think a doc should consider sending this test off? Adjuvant, locally advanced, metastatic?
Certainly there are those who can argue that, you know, 1 month trial of the drug can be done, but I think Ruggiero's data suggests that in an unselected population, you might be better off with chemo. I think that certainly in the adjuvant setting, I'd want to know in an operative situation, because if I were the patient, I would want adjuvant erlotinib if I had an EGFR mutation or were an ever smoker.
So you think the test should be done in all patients?
I think
having
we're
the
available.
Tumors taken
yeah.
out. Arvy, what do you think
Not
about that?
Not that expensive.
And what's the data for that adjuvant erlotinib, if you could enlighten me about that?
I said if I were the patient. I didn't tell you what the data was.
Yeah, well, we have actually seen adjuvant erlotinib, or, you know, at least ERISA, and it harms people, at least
we
in the SWOG study.
We saw it in a completely
different population.
Different population.
But you have absolutely no data whatsoever to support that in the use of an expensive drug with significant toxicity. The adjuvant setting alone, Tom's commented that people should be reluctant to use bevacizumab, a proven drug in a wide range of a population, because of very limited toxicity data in a metastatic group. And now we're going to use erlotinib willy-nilly in an adjuvant setting where we actually have proven therapies. What we haven't shown in any of this stuff is that there's any advantage whatsoever to the use of erlotinib upfront rather than chemotherapy first, drugs that are proven that have validated targets, work in a broad range of population. We haven't shown any harm of using that first and then using erlotinib upon progression in any population. I mean, why not do that and then bring this in if those drugs don't work?
Harvey?
Well, I think that's almost a daily question now over at our place, where people come in and they've been operated on and they know about mutational status and they want to know, well, why not go on this supposedly less toxic erlotinib? In my heart of hearts, for the patient who's a never smoker that has a mutation, I have to say that I can't off trial dissuade, because it makes sense to me. Obviously, though, the data has to be performed so that we have the answer to Marty's question, which is if you put it face up against what we think are the best adjuvant chemotherapies right now, is that the way to go? But I think we're talking about a selected population. I think we're talking about enriching for a population that we're sort of loading the dice for. And in that situation, I can't, let's just say, go against what the patient comes to me who's read all the data and wants to get that and is willing to go that route.
Marty?
I want to see data. Phase 3 may eventually show it. Well, you know what? I have equipoise. That's how I can put a patient on a phase 3 trial. I don't know the answer. And you know, I'll tell you, the most formative moment for me in oncology was as a fellow watching how MACOP-B and Promacitabam died. But you know what? I knew as a fellow that they were better than CHOP. I knew it because we had all this mathematical data. We had fabulous phase 2 data. It was a little bit more toxic. It was hard to give. But I learned something from that, and I learned that I really don't know the answer till I know the answer, and I can bet one way or the other, but I'm willing to do it. I'd put my patients on the study. I intend fully to put my patients on the bevacizumab study with great enthusiasm, and I think we will accrue well to that adjuvant study because I think that now we don't have a no therapy control arm, and that will make it much easier. And I think I've got to say, we really need to see this, and we don't know the right order to give these drugs. And erlotinib is not so harmless. It's a drug with some significant toxicities.
Tom?
I just think you pushed us on this in Houston last year on this issue, and I've softened on this issue as well. I've come more around to where Vince is on this point, that I think that for patients who have mutation-positive disease, you need a detailed discussion with them. And the point, Marty, I'm not saying that for that individual patient, they're not going to be able to wait for the phase 3 trial to be done. Obviously, I endorse the concept of phase 3 trials, and I certainly think enthusiastically we should do them. But for that patient who's mutation positive, I do have a long discussion with them, and I don't think it's crazy to think about adding erlotinib after chemotherapy. Absolutely should give chemotherapy. I'm not saying instead of, but adding erlotinib afterwards. Neil pushed me on that question in Houston, and actually, it was actually one of the things that helped my feeling sort of evolve on that. And I think that since then, I've become more accommodating to patients who want to consider that as an adjuvant option.
I think it's very tough, but I think at the same time, because obviously you have this issue with mutation positivity, but as was shown, those patients do better anyway. You know, it is a prognostic, and who knows in the adjuvant, but I think, do you discuss with them the SWOG data with Arisa, where, you know,
yes,
in a setting where you actually
that's
have the area
the
which should be most sensitive,
that's
you know,
part
the group
of the discussion.
Most sensitive and actually had a worse outcome.
But that's an unselected group of patients.
Well, we don't know that it's worse
that's
outcome.
True. It's unselected. Well, at least it certainly didn't show an advantage and had increased toxicity, and I don't know, I looked at those lines and they're sure as hell the Arisa line is below the other one, and you know, I know
a
it's
lot
not
below.
Statistically.
So Marty, a patient comes into you who's had the test done and it's positive, yeah. You're going to treat them for first line therapy metastatic disease. What's your treatment?
With the mutation.
They come into you for consult and they've got a mutation.
I'm going to sit down and I'm going to discuss with them the fact that they can get chemotherapy first, that that's the most proven thing in front line, and then we can go to that. Or if they've got a mutation, they're probably a never smoker, and I happen to have a trial open for this, which I've already enrolled 3 patients on, and I would happily put them on.
So they're not eligible for the trial.
Would I discuss it?
What do you think your most likely therapy? They turn to you and say, what do you think? What should I do? What's your most likely therapy?
With stage 4
disease? First line.
Okay. I will still argue for chemotherapy in that setting, and then I would tell them that we have this as the second line for it.
Ed looks like he's ready to explode.
I would totally disagree. I mean, there's data there. Even doublet chemotherapy works, what, response rates with doublet chemotherapy are 30% at best in phase 3 trials. I asked people, who are the 91% of people who don't respond to second-line chemotherapy? Yet we believe that it works in all unselected populations. The data is pretty clear that even in the unselected populations from BR21, that you get similar response rates, you get similar survivals. And so there's no reason why in selected patients, especially enriched populations, that these could work better. And I think that's the direction we're going in with biomarkers, is to select patients, no matter if it's biologic therapy, if it's chemotherapy, to figure out what we're doing.
Mark, a couple issues. Number one, because of availability of tissue for the average patient with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, this is a theoretical concept. Let's be frank here. And it's different from breast cancer. You raised the issue before. There, everybody has a biopsy of their primary tumor, and a lot of people have rebiopsy of metastatic disease. It's very simple. It is very hard here. And until technology moves forward, the only group of patients we're going to have that routinely have either FISH or mutation testing on are the adjuvant cases. And that's something different, and we're going to talk about that later. The second thing is that the biology is somewhat different. When we talk about high polysomy here, we're talking about 5 copies or 4 copies. Or amplification, we're talking about 6 copies. Very, very different from the situation in breast cancer. So we have to be very careful about even our technology to measure copy number. And what does it mean? I mean, the differences here are much more subtle. With all the sampling and tissue problems we have, it's much more difficult. And unfortunately for this average patient now with metastatic disease, we're stuck with clinical stuff to make decisions until technology improves.
Rogerio?
How far are we really from coming up with a reliable and validated predictive index for the use of these TKIs in practice? You know, either IHC with FISH or CISH, or is the KRAS mutation sufficiently negative, or is it negative enough that it trumps the other biomarkers? Are we going to come up to that, or are we just going to have to use individualized data?
Tom?
I think we're still a little bit away on that. I think, Rogerio, it's probably still a couple years away that we're going to have an index that actually is able to do that. I think we need to see what the mature results of the first-line trials based on a whole broad range of selection devices are. But I think your point about that the practicing physician is confused is completely true.
Yes.
I think the first year, everyone bought into mutations, thought mutation was the answer. Then mutations got trashed by FISH. And then everyone thought FISH was the answer, and now it's murky. And practicing docs throw their hands up. They actually don't know.
Final comments from Vince.
We have two trials where we have a feel for the power of what erlotinib does in the never smokers, which is a surrogate perhaps for mutation group, or maybe encompasses some other things. We have the BR21 never smokers where the median survival, they did a little bit better with placebo. And we know never smokers in general do a little bit better. But in the never smokers who got erlotinib in a second line setting, they lived more than a year. The median survival was over 12 months. And then we have the TRIBUTE trial, which of course for the never smokers, where again, median survival was more than doubled in the group that got erlotinib. So I think that's a pretty powerful suggestion that this is not just due to the fact that these are a favorable prognostic group, but also predict benefit from the drug. The data we have from the FAM series shows that there's a fairly continuous graph relationship between pack years smoked and likelihood of having an EGFR mutation, but that after 15 pack years, there appears to be a fairly significant drop-off in the likelihood of an EGFR mutation. We're now doing the same plot for KRAS, and obviously we expect to see something that crosses in the other direction, that the incidence of KRAS mutation goes up substantially after the 15 pack year smoking history.
So from a practical perspective, what kind of smoking history would cause you to treat a patient like a non-smoker?
The 15 pack year cutoff is a very reasonable surrogate clinically, and a lot of these patients don't have tissue. You need to be driven by the clinical variables.
Is that 15-pack year still smoking, 15-pack year having quit for a number of years? Does that matter at all, or we don't know that?
In this paper, it was suggested that time away from smoking was also important, but that, of course, is a little bit hard to tease out from pack years. And most of the patients we see now aren't active smokers. So I would say non-active, year or more from smoking.
Roy, what about a PS2 patient with a mutation?
Well, it just relates to everything we're discussing here. I think that selection and personalization of lung cancer is really the only way we're going to truly make a difference. And if someone leaves MD Anderson, who's a never smoker, who doesn't either go on a protocol or get erlotinib either alone or in combination with chemotherapy, we've probably failed because we have to try to enhance the results on a patient. And the comment here with PS2, we do improve their survival somewhat with chemotherapy, but the group that one could really help, and I've seen it a few times in my practice just recently, and I'm sure everyone has, if you get a PS2 patient who's PS2 because of their disease, and they happen to have an EGFR mutation or some other reason why they would better respond to that agent, these are patients who come off the oxygen, who start to walk easier. And that speaks to what we can really start to do in lung cancer. There are going to be other agents besides erlotinib that would work in other mutations and in other areas. So this is an opportunity where selected PS2 patients are going to do very well with biologic therapy. In the unselected population, I wasn't surprised by Ruggiero's result. I don't think anyone here was. It's unselected PS2 is the same as unselected PS1 or 0.
Jack?
I would make a couple of points that I strongly believe that the never smoker population is really an important group to break out, that the 10% translating to 150,000 cases is probably conservative, that on the West Coast, I'm seeing 25-30% of my patients as never smokers. The other point I'd make is about mucinous BAC, and I think that is something that we need to break out a little more in our BAC trials, that these patients are very likely to have RAS mutations, and they've done horribly in our trials, and pooling them may be the equivalent of pooling the mutations as the same when they may have very, very different behaviors.
Rogerio?
Until we can sort out the issue of the biomarkers in a more understandable model, I think, is smoking status for the practicing clinicians perhaps either equal to the biomarkers or sufficient to select patients? Is that what I hear from Mark and Vince, maybe, or others?
You're going to miss people, correct, Tom, if you only used smoking status?
I think right now the burden is on the people looking at biomarkers to prove that it's better than smoking status. I mean, smoking status is a pretty good selection device. I think we'll learn much more from Vincent Posse's trial. But, Ruggieri, I don't think that's a terrible first approximation until we prove that we have something that's better.
But my point, and forgive me if I didn't make it clear enough, is that the people that are never smokers are the ones we have to focus our effort on. Clearly, there are folks that have smoked some that may have some benefit, and that's a separate question. But when we have these people that are never smokers, those are the ones we should use all the modalities we have, and those people should get these drugs and should get them up front.
Final comment from Marty.
I think if you'd asked me this a year ago, I would have been completely with you. I mean, as far as the non-smoking status, and I certainly look at those patients as being incredibly important because the biology there has clearly got to be different. But I have to say this has now become the most disappointing thing for me, which is a fairly substantial percentage of my never smokers. And I agree this number has been increasing for years. And we actually, surprisingly, in Baltimore see a fair amount of these because we're a pretty heavy smoking place. But a number of these people getting fluoride rash, true absolute never smokers, have just progressed merrily through these agents. And yet I've had other patients who have had fabulous responses who were smokers. And so I have to admit, I still use that. And I will tell you, certainly in second line, that's my first key question, which is if you were never a smoker, you absolutely go on erlotinib. And if you were a smoker, then I go to Alimta in a non-study situation. But I really would like to see some way of sorting these people out and perhaps in front line. But in the second line, I've been very surprised that it has not held up as well as I thought it would.
The FAM data is our best attempt to try to do that. But yes, there are people that have mutations and can have some benefit that had some smoking history. But that's a little different question than what I'm trying to say, is that when you have the never smoker, really think about using this.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Again, in second line, this is exactly, I mean, I would go immediately to erlotinib. And as I said, I've been fairly enthusiastically, we've put several patients already on, in just a couple months we've had it open on a CLGB trial evaluating this never smoking issue.
Could I just paraphrase what you said a little bit, if you'd permit me to do that?
I'm not sure it's a good idea.
No, but you raise a very important point, is that you have a patient where you have to make an individual decision and you weigh these factors in. And that's what people really have to do here. There is no perfect thing that's going to tell you exactly what to do for the patient. Even women that have ER-positive breast cancer, some of them still don't respond. People that have HER2-positive breast cancer often don't respond.
I agree with that.
So you just got to pick.
Do we know, Vince, the fraction of patients who are oligo smokers nationally?
So the never smokers are consistently about 10%, and probably when you get up to 15 pack years, you add about another 15%.
So a total 25%?
Yeah, maybe a little 25%.
It also depends on the line of therapy, though. It's interesting, in those second line trials, the never smokers in those unselected trials were over 20%. In the first line trials, they're about 10%.
What about the fraction nationally? Do you agree with those numbers? Total 25%?
Well, the truth is, nobody knows. Nobody has paid any attention to this up until the last couple of years.
Mark?
I think one of the great contributions over the past couple of years has really come from Vince in the whole Sloan group about the fact that you really have to take a detailed smoking history because the molecular profile of the patients differ and the therapeutic options and potential benefit differ. And so I think that's the great message from this kind of thing. I agree, historically we've done it poorly, but I think, as Roy said, we owe it to the patients because you'd hate to have a never smoker walk away without getting therapy with this, or a light smoker. I trust when Vince says they have, and I've seen the 3 or 4 page smoking history questionnaire things that you guys do, and it's a very detailed history. So you presumably get pretty good data from that, certainly better than the historical data.
Certainly shouldn't take a whole lot of time to get this information. I mean, you're talking about 45...
You can hand it to them in the waiting room.
Not this research thing. I'm talking about in community practice.
It has clearly changed the way I practice in my lung cancer patients because my smoking history is different now than it was 3-4 years ago.
Do you want to comment on that, please? I mean, in the quick setting, without the 3-page thing, what do you do now?
Well, before, like Marty said, 3, 4, 5 years ago, you assumed everyone smoked, and you assumed, like, how long did you smoke? And they'd say, oh, 30 years, and the wife would roll their eyes, and how many packs a day, and the wife would roll their eyes. And now I go, how old were you when you started? And I just went through this with the lady that I put on the CLGB study, who she actually figured out for me, had an 8-pack year exposure. And she had it all written out. In college, I did this, I did this, I started, but this is what I did, and this is what I calculate. She knew about the CLGB study, and I hope she didn't falsify her pack year exposure by getting it at 8, but I had to trust her on that. But it's like, when did you start? Tell me how many years you think you smoked, 1, 1.5, 2. When did you stop? Did you start again? This and that and all that kind of stuff. I'd like to kind of corroborate it with the spouse or the significant other and kind of go through that. But I wasn't doing that 3 or 4 years ago.
Mark, what fraction of patients presenting with lung cancer are not currently smoking? Ex-smokers.
85.
85% of new lung cancer patients?
Not where I am.
Mark?
60.
That's still high.
Yeah.
So most people are ex-smokers.
It's most people are now. I mean, this is a trend that began in California. We saw this. I mean, I can remember, and in fact, thinking about these female never smokers back when I was working with Dave, we first began to see this. It's now 15 years ago. We saw these never smokers start to come up. And at that time, even then in California and West Coast, it was mostly ex-smokers. And I think that trend's now moved to the East Coast in an unselected population as well.
There's
more
data
and more
on
people
this,
are stopping.
The chemo prevention trial, yeah. where they did take a good smoking history, stage one cancer, 66%, I believe, were former smokers, and 9 or 8% were never smokers. So it's over 70%.
Right.
That's 10 years ago.
But I practice on Tobacco Road.
Yeah, but that's a chemo prevention
study.
Okay, you practice
in North Carolina.
Really interested.
No,
no,
this was stage one cancer.
Yeah, so in my practice, about 50% of the patients are former smokers, and 10% are never smokers.